Hey, I'd just like to, while you're finding your way back to your seats, I'd like to just maybe mention something else about this. And this comes in with both the anti-discrimination stuff and the definition, the basis of marriage. And I just want to say there's a kind of an underlying theme, and I'd like to hit this as well. And that is, I have often heard from the opposition in these debates and places that, you know, we're imposing our sort of religious morality on people, and how dare we do that. And, you know, there are times and places I've been somewhere, and very often it's a young person, they'll stand up and they'll say, yes, I have a question for you. Who are you to impose your religious beliefs on me when you're thinking about the kind of laws or policies that you want? And very often that is accompanied by some applause, as if these words of wisdom just rolled down from Mount Sinai. The problem is they're not even a quarter inch deep, and most people who, you know, say that just don't stop to really think this thing through. Anybody who's a legislator, you've got perspectives that life has given you. But the Supreme Court has always said if your perspectives and values come from your background, it's up for the voters to decide if that's what they want when they're represented. But, you know, there's a myth that says you can't legislate morality. We legislate morality all the time. The question is whose morality gets put in. There's a myth of neutrality, because there really is no neutrality. And by the way, why do we have laws against murder? Might it have anything to do with the Ten Commandments, you know, saying thou shalt not, you know, kill? Have there been cultures in society that didn't have that background and had different views of that? Yeah. Why do we have laws against stealing? Might it be that the Decalogue has a reference to thou shalt not steal? Why do we view adultery to this day with great disfavor? Somebody who's done that, who's cheated on their spouse, has been dishonorable. You know, why do we have laws against perjury? All these things are found in our Judeo-Christian tradition. So, and the interesting thing is I've been with people who said, I'm an atheist, and I said, well, can your views influence moral policy? And they said, absolutely, and they could be the basis for laws. Well, why is that? Because they're not religious. You almost feel like your head wants to, you know, turn around to try to, you know, understand. Because, you know, in the broadest sense, what's religion is how you organize your beliefs, your view of meaning in the world and in the universe. And it's sort of like, you know, there's just a profound disconnect there. Okay, I'm going to try to rush this a little more because I do want to leave time for something here. Just to mention one other point from the, you know, the past, you know, information. I don't think that there really is I don't think that there's a good legal basis as well as a need basis for these anti-discrimination laws. I think part of the problem is people just get fouled up because, you know, we want to be people who get along. We don't want to be ill thought of. We don't think of ourselves as bigots because we hold moral views or something. And we just genuinely get tripped up because we don't know how to answer those things. And I would just encourage you, if you have those views about this, you know, don't get silenced in the debate. When somebody says, the debate is over, it's done, it's through, it's established. If you disagree, you're a Neanderthal. Don't let your knuckles scrape on the ground when you walk. You can be almost certain the debate is not only not through, but there's stuff that people, that they don't want to talk about. Let me take a completely uncontroversial topic like global warming. All right. Here's the deal, all right? I don't know if there's global. I really don't. I don't know. If there is global warming, I don't know if it's from human activity or volcanoes. If it's from human activity, I don't know what human activity causes it. I don't know if you know, trying to force all of us to drive smart cars is going to really do anything when China is really, you know, putting it. I just don't know the answers. I'd like to hear people talk about it. I'd like to hear criticism of the hockey stick curve. I'm interested when I hear that the emails on the other side that were hacked show that they were fudging the data. I'd like to know more about that. I'd like to know what that means when we weigh what we do with industry and jobs. I'd like to hear about that. But when someone on the other side says, the debate's over, it's happening, it's man-made, and you have to drive, you know, you only drive ride bicycles now. You know, it's like the whole, you realize it just becomes a front for a political agenda. If something is really settled, you don't need to argue it. You don't need to stand up and proclaim every day there's no Santa Claus. It's a settled issue, all right, once you get past 6 or 7 years of age. But those kind of tactics to tell you the debate is done, it's over, and one of the things I hear that really grates on me is you're on the wrong side of history. That's meant to make you feel like you're... Let me tell you something. I'm not concerned about being on the wrong side of history. I'm concerned about being on the wrong side of truth. And there's a myth that wins are permanent or losses are permanent, and it ain't so. And people who fought slavery, for example, did it for centuries. William Wilberforce saw the end of slavery in the British Empire on his deathbed. So I'm not concerned about those kinds of tactics, and I hope that you're not as well. Okay, let me just get to one thing here. Part of the confusion with the whole issue of marriage is, let me just say, in the Supreme Court decision in the Defense of Marriage Act case went into this, and I think it's helpful to understand it. The Justice Alito in particular pointed out, and he said, look, there's a good faith debate in society because there's two views of marriage. One he called the conjugal view. And his explanation of that, he said, it's an exclusive permanent union that is intrinsically ordered to producing new life. In other words, it's about the fact that men and women are different. There's painfully obvious biological differences. There's obvious emotional differences. I'm always intrigued by the emotional, everything about the biological. You know, I can't figure certain things out. Like, I come home at night, if something's bothering me, my wife looks and she says, what's bothering you? I have no idea how she knows. She looks at me and she figures it out. On the other hand, if she's upset, I figure it out because I suddenly hear her crying. And even then, I'm not sure. Even then, I'll look over and I'll go, are you upset about something? And if she says, yes, you have no idea how bad this day was. My first thought is, there's 30 seconds left in overtime. Why did she have to get upset now? Like, will she be really mad at me if I'm like listening to her but going like this? You know? Sort of thing. So there's profound differences that go with, you know, the human difference between how men and women process things and produce human life. And the traditional view for centuries has been, because men and women are capable of producing life, that doesn't happen in every marriage, it doesn't have to, it doesn't need to, but because the potential is there, the government had an interest in having those people stay together to raise those children, because we've learned through mountains of social science evidence that kids tend to do better if they're there in that biological unit, or if they're adopted into a unit that approximates what they would have been born into. That, you know, that's sort of the idea of it, and that's why you have marriage. The sort of the competing view that's very new, you have to understand, this is about a decade old, is that marriage is something like a consent-based relationship based on an emotional union. And it's almost like, well, I love my partner, so you're denying us government recognition. Now, first of all, it's a lie that same-sex couples cannot marry anywhere in the country. Those people can get married, even in the state of Montana. They can call themselves married, they can wear a ring, they can find a church that does that, they can reside together. It is not against the law. This is a very common misconception. The question is, which relationships will the state recognize for the benefits that go with marriage? That's the question. And the government has always said, we don't need to recognize the other unions because they don't have the same potential to produce life. It's not making them less. It's not looking down upon them or saying, we despise you. It's a different kind of relationship. The government doesn't care if you have close friends. We don't give licenses for good friendships. All right? I have two brothers. I love my brothers. I am very deeply emotionally connected to my two brothers. If one of them needed a kidney, I'd give it like that. But we don't redefine marriage because we have a close emotional relationship. But the basis of their argument is that it's a close emotional relationship and it's something like discrimination. So some of the questions that you hear, for example, are, well, what about benefits? Aren't we just denying people benefits when we do this? And this is not the discrimination, but it kind of relates because you often hear them talked about together. The answer is, you don't have to redefine marriage to give benefits. It is a total fallacy. Government can give benefits to any two people that it wants to. You can have reciprocal beneficiary arrangements, they're called. You don't have to redefine marriage because benefits attach to it. If we decide as a culture we think those benefits are so nifty, we're going to give them to any two people who can't marry, then let's give them to a grandmother and a grandson if they need them. Or let's give them to two guys who are good friends and they live in the same house, but they're heterosexual, but they're really good friends and they want something like that. If benefits are that important, you can give the benefits. It's a total red herring. But it was a very attractive emotional appeal to say, we need to create this union of marriage because it's the only way we can get benefits. And it just frankly is not so at all. You also hear that it's sort of like the old laws against interracial marriage. This, again, is a totally false analogy in my view. Those laws were based, again, on these evil moral suppositions that there was a superior race. And if you looked in some of those old laws, they were actually quite bizarre. It was like, you know, certain races could marry, but if you were white, you couldn't. It was like based on ideas of white supremacy. And yet, if you were an American Indian, I think it was in Virginia, they had the Pocahontas exception because they were embarrassed by, I always forget who married Pocahontas, if it was John Smith or John Rolfe or John somebody, or yeah, John Smith, whatever. They didn't know what to do with him. So they said, okay, so you're an honorary, Caucasian if you're, the laws were just bizarre and they were irrational. But the Supreme Court said, but it's still a type of marriage when they struck down those laws because it's a man and a woman. And that's the essential union and historical component of marriage. I'm always surprised when somebody says, yeah, but when the state of, Colorado defined marriage, back in whatever, 1822, they didn't specify it was a man or woman. I'm amazed to hear that because it would have been like the state of Colorado saying water is wet. It never occurred to anybody that marriage could be anything but a man and a woman. This is a new invention, but it is not like racial discrimination. It is not based on an immutable characteristics. And part of the debate, and this is where it gets trickier, is when people say, well, I'm born this way. And the sort of the debate that's come out in the sort of the court cases, because look, if somebody is born a certain way, then there's a better argument to be made that discrimination on the basis of how they're born could be somehow, could be wrong. But what the other side pretty freely admits is that sexual orientation or these gender issues are not genetic. They're definitely not genetic. There's no question. Because there are identical twin studies that completely disprove that. So they won't use the word genetic. Genetics don't change. I can't be, Irish, and one day I wake up and say, I'm tired of being Irish, I think I'm going to be Thai now. And there I am, and I look different. It doesn't work that way. But one of the interesting things that gets sort of buried in this, and in fact there was a you could probably still find it on the internet, Professor Lisa Diamond, like the jewel from University of Utah, did a presentation in like October of 2013 at Cornell University, and she's a leading researcher on the other side. And it was an amazing presentation to watch because she was involved in the marriage case, and her lawyers came to her and said, well, the sexual orientation is immutable. It never changes, right? You're born with it, and that's it. And she's telling the researchers as she's presenting her studies, she says, well, we all know from the research that's not the case. They use the word fluid. Sexual orientation is fluid. It changes all the time. And she's got all the statistics there of what's more likely for men and what's more likely for women. And she's very telling because she says in this, I told the lawyers the other side is basically right. This is not a permanent type of thing. It changes. There are factors in it. This is fluid. It's more of a kind of behavior. And that's sort of the latest thinking anyway there. And so she says, I told the lawyers, I hate to tell you this, but they're right. But that shouldn't be the reason we win. It should still be a protected class anyway, just because we've known discrimination and all these kinds of things. And she makes a joke and she says, and the lawyers told me afterward, it didn't come up in the case. We dodged the bullet there. But, this is, it's kind of an awkward, and you know what? You don't even like to get into this in polite company because I don't like talking about sort of what people's relationships and things. It's kind of, to me, I'm sort of very, proper with that stuff. I don't like to even discuss it. But the bases, for saying that this is, again, like discrimination is just that it's just not there. The other thing is the legal arguments that the people made. We, going way back, said, if you look at these arguments absolutely support things like polygamy. You'd make the same arguments for polygamy. It's just a question of before you present it in court, you'd want the culture to be more accepting of it. And in the early days of the debates, it was very interesting because, the ACLU actually had a position at one time that that polygamy should be legal. They call it polyamory, for some reason. And it was very telling to do debates because they would say things in debates like, well, marriage is this archaic, patriarchal, bourgeois institution that suppresses women and does this, this, and this, and it's based on these outdated notions of Judeo-Christian morality. And when you would ask, then can marriage be whatever any group of people wants it to be as well? They didn't like to admit this, but when pressed, they had to. I actually asked somebody on one occasion, is the number relevant? If it could be 3, could it be 12? Well, yes. If it could be 12, could you fill a stadium with 42,600 people who love each other, are really committed, and need the health benefits? And his answer was, if that's what they want for marriage, it should be. The place where they really got tripped up was when they went as far as saying that even laws like against incest, there's no reason a grown man can't marry his grown daughter, because then what I call the yuck factor kicked in. And then I noticed all at once the tactic changed and they suddenly distanced themselves from the polygamy type arguments because it was very disturbing to people. And I think there was a sense that the culture has to be acclimated to it first. So I think right now, it's sort of like the early days of what we... There's a couple shows, and I don't watch them, but there's a couple shows right now, like My Four Wives, and have anybody of you seen some of those and channel flipping and all that? Oh, look, here I am with my four wives, and isn't this funny, and we get along. She gets to go with me on a weekend for my birthday. Isn't this funny? We all laugh about it. But there's a sort of this gradual lessening of it. I once heard somebody say in a debate, marriage should be anything that people want it to be. And my response to that was, in that case, then marriage means nothing. That's the reality of it. So the same arguments that were made in those cases, and they would say, oh, you always talk about the slippery slope. We can just keep it two people who love each other. It was a dramatic change of tactics, I think, because the culture they felt wasn't ready for that. And I think you're going to see a continued assault on things like marriage, on concepts of gender, and, you know, all of those. But I think as well, the marriage redefinition and these sorts of ordinances positively are a threat to religious liberty. And I think this is the other thing that's sort of interesting. I'll make this my last point because I do want to leave time for questions. I've sat down with people who are even friends on the other side of these debates. Occasionally they're atheists. We have really good discussions. We really try to hear and understand. And one of the things that I've heard from people is, well, you can have your religious beliefs. What's the big deal? You get to go to your church on Sunday and do whatever it is that you do there. And I realize this is a profound disconnect, that they view religion as something that you do in a church on Sunday. Whereas when I look at marriage, and this is not everybody's view maybe in this room, but I look, for example, to the scriptures that say marriage is a picture of Christ in the church. There's theological truth in it. So I look at those things, and it takes a very special meaning for me related to fundamental beliefs that I have based on my faith. And to me, my faith is not what I do on Sunday. My faith is how I live beginning Monday morning. It's how I treat every human being. Do I see every human being I see as made in the likeness and image of God? And I could go on and on, but I'm not going to, because the pastors here could do a much better job of that. And listen to them when they talk about those things. But the point is, there's a sort of disconnect. And I think they just don't get that when the photographer says, my religion doesn't allow me to do this, it's not that she's a bigot. It's that religion really defines her life and creates her values and the way before God she feels compelled to live. So I think that that's one of the divides. I don't know if we'll ever do a better job on that, because the people on the other side say to me, yes, but when your religious views disrespect who I am as a person, then that's a big problem for me. So I think it's very important that we be civil, that we afford respect to people. I don't think it's helpful to anybody when the rhetoric gets ugly and all of that. I don't think that that's the way we're supposed to deal with people. But I certainly ask back, and I say, well, you're talking about that respect. What about the respect for my religious convictions and how I feel compelled to live those out? So that's sort of the state of it. So I would just encourage you all, to not be intimidated by these debates. I think, by the way, that there is going to be, I don't think that we're going to see these trends forever. I am convinced that there will come a time and we will see things swing the other way. I think in times when you finally reach a point that things don't make sense, that there's an infinite number of genders, at some point people just look and they say, this is crazy. I think there are certain basics to how it is, you know, God created human beings. And when you distort that to a point that it sort of denies the essentials of existence, I think at some point finally that just collapses on its own weight. So I am not discouraged by any of that. Okay, with that, let's go to questions. And Dick, you give me the warning sign when we're getting close on questions, okay? So questions, anybody? Yes, sir. The question is, how are these discrimination ordinances legal? And that's an interesting question, because in some cases they're maybe not legal. In some cases, states keep the power themselves to decide what categories can be adopted by states or towns or counties or that kind of thing. But essentially, in the end, judges have to interpret these laws. And it's no secret judges, you know, are ideologically driven. There's a difference in we won a case in the Supreme Court on prayer just recently called Town of Greece. And it upheld the prayer practice going back to the beginning of the nation, where you can have an invocation to open a meeting at a government meeting. It was a 5-4 decision. There's a difference between how the justices appointed by Ronald Reagan and President Obama view those things. So, you know, elections do have consequences. So there are judicial ideologies. That's just part of the system. So, but people do have powers to create. You know, legislatures have powers to create these. But if a legislature, for example, created these rights, so-called, and the practice of them violated my federal constitutional rights, then I would win and it would be struck down. I'll give you two examples. The state of Massachusetts adopted, you know, a long time back, an anti-discrimination law. There was a St. Patrick's Day parade, and the permit holders were approached by a GLBTQ group that said, we want to march and hold banners. The permit holder said, you can march, but you can't hold your banners. It's our parade. We have the permit. The permit holders lost in the highest court in the state of Massachusetts. And they were told, you're a public accommodation. You have to let those people march in your parade. The Supreme Court overturned that in a very strong decision and said, no, you just violated the permit holder's speech rights. It's their permit. It's their parade. They can say what speech they want in it. Your state public accommodation law can't violate their federal constitutional speech rights. Or another example, the Boy Scout case at the Supreme Court. The Boy Scouts were sued in New Jersey. They said, you're violating the New Jersey anti-discrimination laws because you won't have homosexual scoutmasters. And the Boy Scouts said, we're a private organization. The New Jersey Supreme Court said, no, you're a public accommodation. You have to accept these. The Supreme Court reversed that, overruled the New Jersey Supreme Court, and said they have private rights of what's called association. They can associate and define who they are in their private relationships. You can't do that. So one of these days, these issues are going to come up before the Supreme Court with freedom of religion, with freedom of speech, with compelled speech, with rights of conscience, and it'll be interesting to see what the cases and how those come out. Okay, questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, you know, and again, not a pleasant subject, but that's right. Pedophiles are advancing those types of legal claims, and part of what that is they've made arguments in court where they've said, this is just another type of gender orientation variation, and that if we're created this way with this, it should not be criminal activity. So you do see those kinds of legal arguments advanced.